This is Julie Matthews, certified nutrition consultant here on Autism One Radio and my show Nourishing Hope. And we are back with Kara Fitzgerald for our July call. And we are going to be talking to her again. She's from Metametrics, and we're going to be talking more about our conversation last time. And this time I'm going to go into more case studies and how to use some of these laboratory results to get some good information for children on the autistic spectrum. Kara Fitzgerald received her doctorate in naturopathic medicine from the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon, and she completed her residency in nutritional biochemistry and functional laboratory medicine at Metametrics Clinical Laboratory and Progressive Medical Centers in Atlanta, Georgia. She presents annually at a variety of different medical schools, as well as Autism One, the Institute of Women's Health, the Institute of Functional Medicine, and Dr. Fitzgerald maintains a private practice at Spherios Medical Center in Roswell, Georgia. So welcome back, Kara.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Yeah, we had such a great response last time, and we had so much to talk about that we wanted to do this again and go a little bit more into some of the clinical background so that parents and practitioners could really get a hands-on understanding of how this research and how these lab results really translate into supporting their children and understanding some of the best ways to provide intervention for them to sort of support them along their path. So we've chosen a series of case studies today to kind of go through, and it sounds like people will be able to get these case studies as well on the website. What would be the best website if they want to pull down some of those studies before we start?
Well, you know what? I don't have them up at the moment. Well, right now, if they wanted to get them, they could go to the Metametrics, www.metametrics.com website, and then follow the links to the teleconference series. And if they look at the second teleconference series on autism and B vitamins, if they pull up the adjuncted material from that teleconference, they'll have some of these cases. But what we can do is, since we have a link to this radio show on our website, we can also upload these slides and have them available in the next day or so for folks.
Okay, that's great. And maybe it would be possible that we'll also have these on a variety, maybe even my website or something. So I'm certain that people will be able to get them, and it will be fairly self-explanatory, I'm sure, one way or another. So, people also don't need to have them in front of them, but if you are really curious and interested in really diving into some of this, there will be some visual aids if you'd like to print those out or look at those while we're going through of this. Well, we're going to choose a few of the case studies, and we're going to start with Leanne, and she's a 4-year-old female. And tell us a little bit about what she was clinically presenting with.
So she was diagnosed with regressive autism, and there's a gradual onset post-MMR vaccine. So she lost expressive language skills, and her social reciprocity declined, pronounced. And she was no longer able to interact with her parents. She was placed into special education, and she was being taught sign language at the time she did our testing.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what did you find when you looked at some of these, the different tests for her?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we did a urinary organic, we actually did the what we call our ion profile, which includes an amino acid, a plasma amino acid profile. It includes fat-soluble vitamins. It includes homocysteine. We look at toxic metals in the blood. We also look at nutrient metals, and we look at fatty acids as well as the urinary organic acid. So it's we cast a very, very wide net to really follow a lot of different biochemical pathways with the ion profile, and it's one of the go-to profiles for clinicians. In fact, frequently clinicians will do we routinely do a 20 amino acid panel, but clinicians will add on an additional 20 aminos, as many of those compounds give us insight into certain pathways that appear to be problematic in autistic children. So that's what was done with Leanne, and I won't go through every compound. It's quite a process. But the significant ones, the ones that really needed to be dealt with her, included the urinary marker, the organic acid quinolinic acid. So quinolinic acid elevates in an infectious or inflammatory process. So it's stimulated by interferon gamma. Interferon gamma, of course, stimulated, produced in macrophages and stimulated by a Th1 response. So T1 cells are associated with microbes, fungi, bacteria, viruses. They'll stimulate that whole pathway that will ultimately turn up quinolinic acid. In the CNS, quinolinic acid binds with great avidity to the NMDA receptors, the glutamatergic neuronal system, and so they will. That's our excitatory system in the brain, and that is involved in not only increased perception of pain, but it's involved in memory. It's involved in just a number of important events take place with glutamatergic stimulation. They interface with the dopaminergic system. In fact, Dr. Dietz's work looked at both of these in response to perception and a lot of cognitive processes that occur. So anyway, quinolinic acid can really crank these guys up, and it actually can become oxidative, so it can become problematic. There's a great deal of research on quinolinic acid in relation to other neurodegenerative conditions like Parkinsonism, Huntington's, Alzheimer's, even stroke patients. So it can be very pathogenic when it's elevated for a long time, even at a low-grade elevation, or we think if it spikes very, very high, it can be problematic. However, you know, it is a normal part of an immune response, so we all have quinolinate, and, you know, it'll rise and fall normally. In autistic children, we think here in the lab that quinolinate may be part of the pathogenesis or the precipitating event of autism. So when we looked at Leanne, her quinolinic acid was elevated, so we knew she was inflamed, had some kind of infection, a Th1-driven response, and her whole, you know, the glutamatergic NMDA receptors were really upregulated. And below that, we also then want to look at oxidative stress to see if that's also elevated, as we frequently see in children on the spectrum, and indeed hers is. So she has a elevation of something called 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine. Guanosine might ring a bell with folks. That's part of the DNA. And during the normal reparation process, when DNA is repairing, it'll, you know, clip things off, and one of the things it removes is 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine. So it's a normal thing to have going on in the body. You should be spilling out a little bit of this because DNA is constantly repairing itself. However, we don't want to see it in excess. And in the case of Leanne, we see excess DNA, 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine. So we're concerned about increased oxidative stress with her.
So with the, do we have an idea of what kicked this off? Are you thinking that it might be an infection that kicked this off?
Yes, because gradual onset post-MMR, yes.
Okay.
Her immune system was absolutely aggressively stimulated, as it's supposed to be with MMR. But as we know, you know, there's a subset of individuals who don't respond normally to MMR.
Right.
You know, who really have problems, and regressive autism appears to be one of them. Okay, so her immune system was absolutely stimulated, and we're arguing that it was stimulated inappropriately, that perhaps quinolinate was still up in this individual at this specimen, which was a good deal after she had the vaccine. It would have been interesting to just, you know, keep looking at her urinary organic acids and seeing how high it spiked when she had the MMR, you know, and how long it stayed at that elevation. You know, just really look closely at quinolinic acid. I think it's something that we would like to do very much here at the lab.
Go ahead.
Well, it was just because we just routinely see it elevated in children on the spectrum, and my the director here, Dr. Richard Lord, who's a biochemist, has speculated, you know, a theory that he's really putting together is that the spike in clinolinic acid is involved in the precipitation of regressive autism.
Hmm.
So it cranks up and it turns those excitatory neurons on. We're unable to normally respond to it, and it becomes oxidative, and then it, you know, goes on to overwhelm other systems, like the transsulfuration and methylation, you know, so glutathione, and, you know, the different systems that are able to quench a oxidative assault are, you know, rendered useless, and then the precipitation of regressive autism begins. So we're wondering if this is not part of the story.
And inflammation, especially inflammation in the brain, has been shown in a lot of people with autism. Is the inflammation that we're, interpreting from this test, is that typically where people see the inflammation, or can it?
Yes, there have been a couple of, yeah, absolutely. We have seen some research associating glutamatergic dysregulation with ASD, like, for instance, Dr. Deep's work keeps focusing on the D4 receptors, mm-hmm. The dopamine system, but he does discuss the interface with the NMDA receptors as part of the issue, and I wish I could speak about that more eloquently, but I can't.
That's okay. I've heard him speak probably 4 or 5 times, and I still only get the very basics, so this is probably helping me paint together the picture better than all of those details, so that's great. What are some of the other elements on her tests that were showing up, you know, to paint this picture of an abnormal biochemistry?
Sure. Okay, so we have these two pieces of information, that clinolinic acid is elevated in her and that oxidative stress is also occurring, excess oxidative stress occurring in her. So then we look at her ability to respond, you know, what's going on with, why is oxidative stress at such a high level in this individual? And we look at her nutrients involved in, you know, the various pathways associated with our endogenous antioxidant system. So we're looking at methylation and sulfation, and we see that her magnesium is low, right at the bottom, low of normal. Her selenium is actually very low, below our reference range, and zinc, again, very, very low. So we know these three trace elements are very much involved in appropriate immune responses and generating adequate glutathione and recycling homocysteine to methionine, you know, and just all over the place. Magnesium alone is involved in over 350 enzymatic reactions. We use magnesium all the time. Selenium helps us recycle glutathione, and zinc, of course, is involved in many different enzymes related to, you know, redox activity or antioxidant support, as well as just helping normal, you know, keep the structure of DNA patent. There's something called zinc fingers that sit on the surface of DNA and help post-transcriptionally, or help, you know, the proteins that come off of DNA. So it's just such an important nutrient to be replete in, and all sorts of challenges have been associated with low zinc, including immunochallenges. So she's rock bottom in some very, very key elements that are likely playing into her inability to respond to this immuno assault that she's undergoing.
Sure. And, you know, sometimes you look at these tests and, you know, she's technically on the lower side, but you can see that there's not the L next to it. And so sometimes people look at it and will say and sort of think, well, she's not in, you know, the lab isn't indicating that she's low, you know, like the other ones, like the selenium, actually have an L next to it, and it's clear that it's below that line. How does a parent or someone determine what low is, and if something's on the borderline, how would somebody interpret that? Is it, if it's on the lower side, like magnesium, but you're saying that, you know, it is low and potentially part of the problem, how would someone determine that?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. So there's frank lows, as we see with selenium and vanadium and zinc there, and then there's low normals, like we see with chromium, copper, and magnesium. So really the only normal nutrients that we look at here are manganese and potassium, and those are actually not great, but they're at least a little higher than low normal.
Okay.
I guess that the easiest way is you could just sort of look at the colors, and green is good, and she's only in green with manganese and potassium. Everything else you can see that is it's either a frank deficiency or it's a low.
Okay.
It's lower than we like to see, even though it's still within the normal.
Sure.
So, there's a really interesting piece of information to get when you look at this. When you see so many low, we want to take a few steps back and say why.
Hmm.
You know, why is everything low? What is her diet like?
Mm-hmm.
Does she have pancreatic? You know, is her system, is her alimentary canal functioning optimally,
mm-hmm.
so that she can break all these macronutrients down and liberate the micronutrients? That takes HCL, that takes pancreatic enzymes, that takes a nice patent mucosa in the gastrointestinal tract. I mean, there's just a symphony of events that have to occur to allow the breakdown and liberation and absorption and transport of these micronutrients. Lots of things have to occur. And as we know, gut is so frequently part of the problem in AFC.
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
We know that it's just a huge issue. So when you see this this pattern where everything's over to the left,
mm-hmm.
then we're thinking, then we want to step back and say why, you know, and then we want to think about gut. So I would say that to answer your question, just a left trend.
Got it.
Is something that we need to raise our eyebrows.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, obviously, though, let me validate what you're saying too, and say obviously magnesium, still within limits, is better than,
sure.
say, the zinc, which is, you know, a whole couple points below,
right.
the reference limit. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So zinc is a severe deficiency, whereas magnesium is low normal.
Right. Well, let's look at the next set of markers, and we have the opposite situation here, which is we have a lot of right justified high numbers in the B-complex markers. So can you talk a little bit about what those mean?
Yeah, okay, so we're looking at some urinary compounds, some organic acids. Let's see, the first two that are elevated are alpha-keto groups, and so they're metabolites coming from branched-chain amino acids, and these are normal metabolites produced that are moving their way through these branched-chain amino catabolic pathways onto different things, and we know when there's an accumulation of a compound in the middle of the pathway, an excess accumulation, it frequently points to the enzyme just past that compound is not functioning optimally.
Hmm.
And if you're into that, looking at enzymes and pushing their ability to function normally and the cofactors and nutrients associated with normal enzymatic functioning, a researcher named Bruce Ames has done a lot of really, really great and fascinating writing on this.
Hmm.
So these two keto groups in this little girl are really quite elevated, and we know that they both require a dehydrogenase complex to move through their pathways, and that dehydrogenase complex uses the nutrients B1, B2, B3, B5, and alpha-lipoic acid. So it's a huge enzyme that's, you know, multifaceted, lots of steps to it, that take these keto groups on to their next compound, to the next compound. And the weakest link in this big complex tends to be B1, also called thiamine. Okay. However, I would recommend, and I do recommend routinely, to supplement with a nice B complex when we see these elevated. But emphasis on thiamine. These compounds gain notoriety as being what's routinely tested for in maple syrup urine disease.
Okay.
And we do know that there's a thiamine-responsive maple syrup urine disease, and so this is information about pushing an enzyme, sort of really kind of forcing it to work by surrounding it with tons of cofactor.
Hmm.
You just put it into a really good milieu where it just doesn't have to work as hard. It has lots of B1 hanging around. So that's a thiamine-responsive maple syrup urine disease. And they give kids up to 4 grams of thiamine who have maple syrup urine disease. And in some cases, they can get the enzyme running. Sometimes the genetic issue is so strong that they can't. Now, we're not looking at necessarily a genetic issue here with these. They're not profoundly elevated to that extent, but they're up enough where we're thinking about supporting with those cofactors to get these pathways moving. So thiamine is the big player, but as I said, B2, B3, B5, and alpha lipoic acid. And then the marker just below that, and you know, parents, you'll be able to see this when we upload the PowerPoint, and I apologize that you don't have that in front of you, because it can be challenging to listen to this without being able to see. But the marker just below that is another urinary marker called xanthuronic acid, or xanthurinate. Xanthurinate is a metabolite of the tryptophan kynurenine pathway. And again, and it's a sensitive marker for B6 deficiency. So they've shown in research that in B6 deficiency, one of the early and sensitive markers of deficiency will be an elevation of xanthuronic acid in the urine. And upon supplementing with B6, I'll see this marker normalize, and xanthuronic acid will be able to move through its pathway. So she, you can see, has a bit of a B6 issue too.
Sure, and there's a couple methylation markers, it looks like, that are also elevated.
Yes.
What's that telling
us? So we're looking. So methylmalonate, as you pointed out, is also elevated, and that's a sensitive and specific marker for B12. Now, I should say, sometimes there are genetic polymorphisms associated with these that could crank it up, but it's, you know, just much, 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 much less common. Methylmalonate has lots of research behind it as being very sensitive and specific for B12. In fact, it'll elevate before you'll see a lot of other routinely used markers for B12 deficiency. I think that methylmalonate will elevate in as little as like maybe 2 weeks in a B12 deficiency. So anyway, we can see that she's got methylmalonate elevated, so requiring some B12, and then below that, formiminoglutamate is a compound related to folic acid. So it requires folic acid to move through its pathway, and again accumulates in the urine when there's inadequate folic acid. And you're right, these guys are key. You know, B6, B12, folic acid, key, as is B1 in normal methylation and sulfation pathway function.
Right, which we talked about in the last call. And let's talk a little bit about the sulfation pathway, and then I would love to go on to a second case study. What can you say about these sulfation markers?
She has, in her case, Leanne has a real elevated sulfate. And frequently we see in children on the spectrum a low sulfate marker. So that's a marker of total body sulfur status. It's been demonstrated. So it's actually looking at inorganic sulfate, but research has shown that it's reflective of total body sulfur status. And we know that sulfur, in the form of cysteine, the amino acid cysteine, is key in glutathione synthesis. In fact, you know, it's the rate-limiting step, the production of cysteine into glutathione. And so we're really concerned about low sulfate in children on the spectrum. Now, she's got lots, but I suspect that she is supplementing with something exogenous and bumping that sulfur marker up. So, you know, you have to do some clinical sleuthing as well.
Sure.
Unfortunately, though, this elevation is not adequate to normalize the oxidative stress, or it hasn't done so yet. She needs the additional support of those all the other cofactors that we've talked about. And you can see that, just reflected in the low elements and the low Bs and so forth. So despite sulfur repletion, she still certainly is in need of support. So the symphony of cofactors are required.
And is the low homocysteine, is that the homocysteine isn't recycling back up to methionine, or that it's broke, that the conversion to homocysteine isn't happening? What does that low homocysteine typically indicate?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and it's something that Jill Jane saw, and we saw here in the lab. We actually did some data mining of children on the spectrum and found that they were significantly lower, their homocysteine levels, than normal children in the population, the control group that we used. So homocysteine, as you know, the word implies cysteine, and as I just said, that's the rate limiter in glutathione production. So low homocysteine is going to really you know, cause a red flag, because we're going to, you know, that cysteine residue that glutathione so desperately needs is in low supply. Mm-hmm. So you know, what Jill James theorized, or what she demonstrated in some of her papers, was this, that there was a recycling issue back up to methionine, and that whole methylation pathway in numerous steps appeared to have lesions. So normally, in an oxidative assault, methylation will stop. Like, the enzymes won't be able to operate in that oxidative milieu to take homocysteine and drive it down into glutathione production. So that's a normal physiologic response to oxidative stress. However, you know, as that oxidative stress is resolved, methylation opens back up and things return to normal. In autistic children, that just doesn't appear to be the case. So homocysteine is low, and there's an accumulation of a precursor to homocysteine, S-adenosyl homocysteine.
Mm-hmm.
And so different steps in the pathway appear blocked, and as we showed earlier, the B12 and the folic acid that she needs are also in low supply, as is magnesium and zinc, et cetera. So we can see just on a nutrient level that she's got some challenges. So what Jill James and Dr. Neubrander showed in their research was injections of methylcobalamin, methyl B12, and folinic acid, as well as betaine, and betaine is another methyl donor similar to B12 and folic acid, not only opened up methylation and restored functioning, it increased homocysteine and opened up the production of glutathione.
Hmm.
So it was just a small study, but it was beautiful. I mean, it was just so powerful in its elegance of pointing out, you know, just the opening of those two very, very important pathways that have been shown to be problematic in children on the spectrum. Powerful piece of research. And she later went on to demonstrate that there appears to be increased incidence of genetic, mild genetic polymorphisms in pathways relating to methylation and transsulfuration in autistic children. So if there's no one, we can't put our finger at one issue, but what we can do is look at lots of markers involved in normal functioning and figure out, by casting a wide biochemical net, where we need to treat and how we need to get this child's system operating.
And it looks like her clinician, her treatment plan was doing the GFCF diet, multivitamin, mineral formula, probiotics, some NAC, B12, fish oils, enzymes, and then it looks like she did some detox with some sauna and some homeopathic remedies. What were some of her follow-up results that she had after doing some intervention?
So, similar to the James study, where they showed anecdotally, unfortunately, they didn't track it in the research. They language was one of the first things to change in the study, so an increased ability to speak and, you know, return to using language happened in that study, and that's what we saw with Leanne. So really within a month, Leanne was speaking again. I mean,
wow,
kind of just remarkable, and they were able to discontinue the sign language.
Wow.
She was actually speaking in a month. Just amazing. I mean, she still had some of her other issues, you know, social reciprocity and so forth were still very limited, but how heartening, you know, how wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that the test really reflected, you know, the potential for a real positive prognosis, because there were real clear-cut lesions, real clear-cut issues that needed to be treated. And I do want to say that the ion test is such an important part of the process, but it's not everything. Like, they did need to do a gluten-free, casein-free diet, and so they did assess food sensitivities and so forth, and frequently a stool analysis is involved. I mean, you know, maybe a more aggressive look at metal burden and so forth. So there are other legs to the treatment. And they did. They covered those bases, but the ion was a big part of it. And so continuing treatment in 6 months, so this was fairly recently, Leanne ran to her father for a hug.
Nice.
Yeah,
that's a nice way to end.
It really is, yes. So social reciprocity, obviously, being restored in this little girl.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Wow. Well, I'm trying to figure out, since we are almost out of time, do we want to talk a little bit about Philip and just kind of give a...
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the lessons learned or some of the things that we can do for kids like Philip. It seems like he doesn't have an autistic spectrum disorder, but his parents are concerned, and he has some IBS and eczema and allergies and some of those types of things. And let's talk about, you know, how this might, you know, instead of going into all of the markers on this one, let's just talk a little bit about some of the findings, and then also how that affects how you might work with maybe others members of the family that don't, you know, maybe one child has an ASD and the other one doesn't, but has some of these other markers similar to what Philip has or these symptoms, and then how might a parent, you know, like how might that influence what they do for their next pregnancy or what they do about vaccinations for these other kids and things like that?
you just said it better than I could have said it myself. I think that the best treatment for autism is going to be prevention. Oh, and we just, again, I mean, I just embrace that, and we embrace that here at the lab wholeheartedly. Mm. Prevention, prevention. We scream it from the rooftops, and yes, and it would be beautiful if the powers that be stepped up and got in alignment with that, and we could begin to do things like looking at a mom's biochemistry prior to conception, you know, a mother and father's prior to conception, or a child's biochemistry prior to vaccination. So, as you mentioned, what we see in the case of Philip is a kid who's hitting all his milestones. He's doing pretty good, but, you know, there's some concern there. He's got IBS, he's got chronic upper respiratory infection, and he's got eczema. Actually, that's a fairly typical kid these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing with Philip, though, that's really striking is when we look at his organic acids, when we look at all those markers, it's an eerie pattern. It's eerily familiar. It's, wow, we just saw this, and, you know, we just saw that elevated quinolinic acid and that elevated oxidative stress marker, and we know Philip is due to go for another round of vaccines. So the huge question, and this was not my patient, but when I was speaking with the clinician, I said, consider aggressive intervention before this child goes for his next round of vaccines, please. You know, and look and see if these markers are normalized before he goes in, because he's already fragile, you know, biochemically. His immune system is already, you know, cranking with that quinolinic acid. He's already under oxidative stress. He doesn't have adequate Bs. He's very deficient in B6 and some of the other markers. So it's such an important piece of the puzzle. So treat this boy, you know, if you're going to follow the vaccine schedule, and, you know, be real careful. I would, you know, if I was the clinician, I would recommend that the parents face the vaccines out if they're, you know, and I mean, I would really want to look at a lot of variables, but I would certainly want these markers normalized. I would really want to give him everything that he needs to be able to mount an appropriate immune response and not initiate any sequela, any problems like regressive autism.
Okay, wow. And similarly for, let's talk just briefly about prevention in terms of what parents and moms could do, that let's say Philip's mom was going to have another child. What might she want to do before she has another one? Just like we want to boost up Philip before he has some vaccinations, what can we do to boost up mom?
Well, know that, you know, mom's nutritional status is going to be inherited by baby.
Hmm.
You know, just, I mean, we know this to be true, and we know that can impact, you know, epigenetics is kind of a cool term, you know, the way that we express the proteins, you know, dictated by our genes. And, I mean, we know that that just plays a huge role. We're just beginning to scratch the surface. So what can mom do? You know, I'm a laboratory. I'm in the lab. I would say, without question, look and see what's going on. Look and see what kind of biochemical lesions are present in mom and dad.
Hmm.
You know, and treat those before conception, if possible,
right,
or during. You know, make sure that the all-important fatty acid, DHA, is in, you know, in mom in adequate amounts to be able to pass on to baby, so baby's nervous tissue is developed normally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make sure that there's adequate zinc so that, you know, that the DNA proteins are patent in adequate magnesium. And just make sure mom has all those things so that she can just bathe baby in the appropriate nutrients while
Great.
The fetus is growing.
Great. Well, how can people get a hold of you if they have clinical questions? Is there a good email address for you?
Sure. So if parents are interested in talking to me with my clinician hat on, I would recommend just emailing me at the clinic, and that's Kara at Spherios, S-P-H-E-R-I-O-S, Spherios.com.
And if they have more questions related to the laboratory information and the Metametrics piece of it?
Yes. Well, I would definitely draw you to the website. The website is a fabulous resource, but you can also email me directly at kfitzgerald, F-I-T-Z-G-E-R-A-L-D, at metametrics.com. Well, and if you you can ask me clinical questions at the lab address. I'm most often here at the lab,
okay.
But that would be, both you can access me through both.
Great, and they can go to metametrics.com to get more information, M-E-T-A-M-E-T-R-I-X, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have sheets on all these tests that break them down pretty straightforward if parents were interested in them.
Great. Yeah, I've often told parents or suggested parents go there and kind of look around and see, if there's any. Sometimes parents, since they know their children so well and they know what their children seem to be presenting with, if they spend a little time looking around, they have a pretty good idea of some of the tests they might want to run. So it's always, and it's also a great just learning experience to see what can be tested for and what the markers mean and things like that.
Yes.
Well, Kara, thank you very much for joining us again on Autism One Radio. This has been a great show, and I really, really appreciate it, and packed with information as always. And so I just wanted to thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You are listening to Nourishing Hope on Autism One Radio. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant. You can find more about this show at you can go to healthfulliving.org to find out more about me, but you can also go to nourishinghope.com and autismone.com. Thanks so much for listening.